The Last American, a fragment from the journal of Khan Li, Prince of Dimf Yuchur, and Admiral in the Persian Navy, presented by J. A. Mitchell. Copyright 1899. 13th of May. A startling discovery this morning. By landing higher up the river, we explored a part of the city where the buildings are of a different character from those we saw yesterday. Nofo considers them the dwellings of the rich. In shape, they are like bricks set on end, all very similar, uninteresting, and monotonous. We noticed one where the doors and shutters were still in place, but rotting from the fantastic hinges that supported them. A few hard blows brought down the outer doors in a dusty heap, and as we stepped upon the marble floor within, our eyes met an unexpected sight. Furniture, statues, dingy pictures in crumbling frames, images in bronze and silver, mirrors, curtains, all were there, but in every condition of decay. We knocked open the iron shutters and let the light into the rooms, sealed up for centuries. In the first one lay a rug from Persia. Faded, moth-eaten, gone in places, it seemed to ask us with dying eyes to be taken hence. My heart grew soft over the ancient rug, and I caught a foolish look in Levelhaydid's eye. As we climbed the moldering stair to the floor above, I expressed surprise that cloth and woodwork should hold together for so many centuries, also saying, "These Americans were not so unworthy as we think them." "That may be," said Levelhaydid, "but the Persian rug is far the freshest object we have seen, and that perchance was ancient when they bought it." On this floor we entered a dim chamber, spacious and once richly furnished. When Levelhaydid pushed open the shutters and drew aside the ragged curtains, we started at the sight before us. Upon a wide bed in the center of the room lay a human form, the long yellow hair still clinging to the head. It was more a mummy than a skeleton. Around the bed lay moldering fragments of the once white sheets that covered it. On the rings of the left hand glistened two rings which drew our attention. One held a diamond of great price, the other was composed of sapphires and diamonds most curiously arranged. We stood a moment in silence, gazing sadly upon the figure. "Poor woman," I said, "left us to die alone." "It is more probable," said Nofo, "she was already dead, and her friends, departing perhaps in haste, were unable to burn the body." "Did they burn their dead?" I asked. "In my history, 'twas writ they buried them in the earth like potatoes and left them to rot." And Nofo answered, "At one time it was so, but later on, as they became more civilized, the custom was abandoned." "Is it possible," I asked, "that this woman has been lying here almost 1,000 years, and yet so well preserved?" "I also am surprised," said Nofo. "I can only account for it by the extreme dryness of the air in absorbing the juices of the body and retarding decay." Then, lifting tenderly in his hand some of the yellow hair, he said, "She was probably very young, scarce 20. "Were there women fair?" I asked. "They were beautiful," he answered, "with graceful forms and lovely faces, a pleasure to the eye. Also were they gay and sprightly, with much animation." Thereupon cried Levelhaydid, "Here are the first words thou hast uttered, O Nofo, that cause me to regret the extinction of this people. There is ever a place in my heart for a blushing maiden." "Then let thy grief be of short life," responded Nofo, "for American damsels were not of that description. Blushing was an art they practiced little. The shyness thou so lovest in a Persian maiden was to them an unknown thing. Our shrinking daughters bear no resemblance to these Western products. They strode the public streets with roving eyes and unblushing faces, holding free converse with men as with women, bold of speech and free of manner, going and coming as it pleased them best. They knew much of the world, managed their own affairs, and devised their own marriages, often changing their minds in marrying another other than the betrothed." "Bismillah! And men could love these things?" exclaimed Levelhaydid with much feeling. "So it appears. But I should say the American bride had much the freshness of a dried fig." "So she had," said Nofo, "but those who know only the dried fig have no regret for the fresh fruit. But the fault was not with the maidens. Brought up like boys, with the same studies and mental development, the womanly part of their nature gradually vanished as their minds expanded. Vigor of intellect was the object of a woman's education." Then Levelhaydid exclaimed with great disgust, "Praises be to Allah for his aid in exterminating such a people." And he walked away from the bed, and began looking for about the bedchamber. In a moment he hastened back to us, saying, "Here are more jewels, also money." Nofo eagerly took the pieces. "Money," he cried, "money will tell us more than the pages of history." There were small silver coins of different sizes, and two small pieces of copper. Nofo studied them closely. The latest date is 1957, he said, a little less than 1,000 years ago. But the piece may have been in circulation some years before this woman died. Also, it may have been coined the very year of her death. It bears the head of Dennis, the last of the Hibernian dictators. The race is supposed to have become extinct before 1990 of their era. I then said, Thou hast never told us, O Nofel, the cause of their disappearance. There were many causes, he answered. The Americans themselves were of English origin, but people from all parts of Europe came here in vast numbers. Although the original comers were vigorous and hardy, the effect of climate upon succeeding generations was fatal. They became flat-chested and thin, with scanty hair, fragile teeth, and weak digestions. Nervous diseases, unknown to us, wrought deadly havoc. Children were reared with difficulty. Between 1945 and 1960, the last census of which any record remains, the population decreased from 90 millions to less than 12 millions. Climatic changes, like of which no other land ever experienced, began at that period and finished in less than 10 years, a work made easy by nervous natures and rapid lives. The temperature would skip in a single day from burning heat to winter's cold. No constitution could withstand it, and this vast continent became once more an empty wilderness. Much more of the same nature, he told us, but I am too sleepy to write longer. We explored the rest of the mansion, finding several things of interest. I caused several objects to be carried aboard the Zlotub. May 14th. Hotter than yesterday. In the afternoon we rowed up the river and landed for a short walk. It is unsafe to brave the sun. The more I learn of these Americans, the less interesting they become. Nofel is of much the same mind, judging from our conversation today as we walked along together. It was in this wise. Khan Lee, how I like the houses, how monotonous. Nofel, so also were the occupants. They thought alike, worked alike, ate, dressed, and conversed alike. They read the same books, they fashioned their garments as directed, with no regard for the size or figure of the individual, and copied to a stitch the fashions of Europeans. Khan Lee, but the close-fitting apparel of the European must have been sadly uncomfortable in the heat of American summer. Nofel, so probably it was. Stiff boxes of varying patterns adorned the heads of men. Curious jackets with tight sleeves compressed the body. The feet throbbed and burned in close-fitting casings of unyielding leather, and linen made stiff by artificial means was drawn tightly around the neck. Khan Lee, Allah, what idiots! Nofel, even so are they considered. Khan Lee, to what quality of their minds do you attribute such love of needless suffering? Nofel, it was their desire to be like others, a natural feeling in vulgar people. 15th of May. A fair wind from the west today. We weighed anchor and sailed up the eastern side of the city. I did this as Nofel finds the upper portion of the town much richer in relics than the lower, which seems to have been given up to commercial purposes. We sailed close under one of the great monuments in the river, and are at loss to divine its meaning. Many iron rods still dangle from the tops of each of the structures. As they are in a line, one with the other, we thought at first they might have once been connected and served as a bridge, but we soon saw they were too far apart. Came to anchor about 3 miles from the old mooring. Up the river and down north, south, east, and west, the ruins stretch away indefinitely, seemingly without end. Am anxious about Level Hadid. He went ashore and has not returned. It is now after midnight. 16th of May. Praise Allah, my dear comrade is alive. This morning we landed early and began our search for him. As we passed before the building, which bears the inscription Dorf Astoria, upon its front we heard his voice from within to answer to our calls. We entered, and after climbing the ruined stairway found him seated upon the floor above. He had a swollen leg from an ugly sprain, and various bruises were also his. While our friends were constructing a litter on which to bear him hence, we conversed together. The walls about us bore traces of having once enclosed a hall of some beauty. In idling about, I pulled open the decaying door of an old closet and saw upon the rotting shelves many pieces of glass and earthenware of fine workmanship. Taking one in my hand, a small wine cup of glass, I approached my comrade, calling his attention to its slender stem and curious form. As his eyes fell upon it, they opened wide in amazement. I also observed a trembling of his hand as he reached forth to touch it. Then he recounted to me his marvelous adventure of the night before, but saying before he began, Thou knowest, O Prince, I am no believer in visions, and I should never tell the tale but for thy discovery of this cup. I drank from such an one last night, proffered by a ghostly hand. I would have smiled, but he was much in earnest. As I made a movement to sit beside him, he said, "Taste first, O my master, of the grapes hanging from yonder wall." I did so, and to my great surprise found them of an exquisite flavor, finer even than the cultivated fruit of Persia, sweeter and more delicate, of a different nature from the wild grapes we have been eating. My astonishment appeared to delight him, and he said with a laugh, "The grapes are impossible, but they exist. Even more absurd is my story." And then he narrated his adventure. It was this, what Lev el-Hadid saw. Yesterday, after nightfall, as he was hastening toward the Zlotab, he fell violently upon some blocks of stone, wrenching his ankle and much bruising himself. Unable to walk upon his foot, he limped into this building to await our coming in the morning. The howling of wolves and other wild beasts as they prowled about the city drove him, for safety, to crawl up the ruins of the stairway to the floor above. As he settled himself in a corner of this hall, his nostrils were greeted with the delicious odor from the grapes about his head. He found them surprisingly good and ate heartily. He soon after fell into a sleep which lasted some hours, for when he awoke the moon was higher in the heavens, and the voices of the wolves were hushed and the city was silent. As he lay in a reverie, much absorbed with his own thoughts, he gradually became aware of mysterious changes taking place, as if by stealth, about him. A decorated ceiling appeared to be closing over the hall. Mirrors and tinted walls slowly crept in place of ivy and crumbling bricks. A faint glow grew stronger and more intense until it filled the room with a dazzling light. Then came softly into view a table of curious form, set out with flowers and innumerable dishes of glass and porcelain, as for a feast. Standing about the room, he saw solemn men with beardless faces, all in black attire, whose garments bore triangular openings upon the chest to show the shirt beneath. These personages, he soon discovered, were servants. As he gazed in bewilderment, there entered other figures, two by two, who took their seats about the table. These later comers, 60 or more, were men and women walking arm in arm, the woman in rich attire of unfamiliar fashion and sparkling with precious stones. The men were clad like the servants. They ate and drank and laughed and formed a brilliant scene. Lev el-Hadid rose to his feet and, moved by a curiosity he made no effort to resist, for he is a reckless fellow and knows no fear, he hobbled out into the room. They looked upon him in surprise and seemed much amused at his presence. One of the guests, a tall youth with yellow mustaches, approached him, offering a delicate crystal vessel filled with a sparkling fluid. Lev el-Hadid took it. The youth raised another from the table, and with a slight gesture as if in salutation, he said in words which my comrade understood, though he swears it was a language unknown to him, "We may meet again in the 4th of next month." He then drank the wine, and so did Lev el-Hadid. Hereupon, the others smiled as if at their comrade's wit, all save the women, whose tender faces spoke more of pity than of mirth. The wine flew to his brain as he drank it, and things about him seemed to reel and spin. Strains of fantastic music burst upon his ears. Then, all in rhythm, the women joined their partners and whirled about him with a lightsome step, and, moving with it, his throbbing brain seemed to dancing from his head. The room itself, all swaying and quivering with the melody, grew dim and stole away from view. The music died softly away. Again was silence, the moon above looking calmly down upon the ivied walls. He fell like a drunken man upon the floor, and did not wake till our voices called him. Such is his tale. He has a clear head, and is no liar, but so many grapes upon an empty stomach, with the fever from his swollen limb, might well explain it. Bear's meat for dinner. This morning, toward noon, Kuzundam, the second officer, wandered on ahead of us and entered a large building in pursuit of a rabbit. He was about to descend into the basement below when he saw close before him a bear leisurely mounting the marble stairs. Kuzundam is no coward, but he turned and ran as he never ran before. The bear, who seemed of a sportive nature, also ran, and in close pursuit. Luckily for my friend, we happened to be near, otherwise, instead of our eating bear's meat, the bear might have lunched quietly off Kuzundam in the shady corridors of Fifth Avenue Hotel. The 17th of May. Today, a scorching heat that burns the lungs. We started in the morning, prepared to spend the night ashore and explore the northern end of the city. It was a pleasant walk through the soft grass of the shady streets, but in those places unsheltered from the sun, we were as fish upon a frying pan. Other dwellings we saw, even larger and more imposing than the ones we entered yesterday, We were tempted to explore them, but Level Hadid wisely dissuaded us, saying the day was waxing hotter each hour, and it could be done on our return. In the northern part of the town are many religious temples, with their tall towers like slender pyramids, tapering to a point. They are curious things, and surprisingly well-preserved. The interiors of these temples are uninteresting. Nofur says the religious rites of the Madigans were devoid of character. There are many religious beliefs, all complicated in insignificant variations from one another, each sect having its own temples and refusing to believe as the others. This is amusing to a Persian, but mayhap was a serious matter with them. One day in each week they assembled, the priests reading long moral lectures written by themselves, with music hired by singers. They then separated, taking no thought of temple or priest for another 7 days. Nofel says that they were not a religious people, that the temples were filled mostly with women. In the afternoon we found it necessary to traverse a vast pleasure ground, now a wild forest, but with traces still visible of broad promenades and winding driveways. There remains an avenue of bronze statues, most of them yet upright, and in good condition, but very comic. Level Hadid and I think them caricatures, but Nofel is positive they were serious efforts, and says the Medicans were easily pleased in matters of art. We lost our way in this park, having nothing to guide us as in the streets of the city. This was most happy, as otherwise we should have missed a surprising discovery. It occurred in this wise. Being somewhat overcome by the heat, we halted upon a little hill to rest ourselves. While reclining beneath the trees, I noticed unusual carvings upon a huge block against which Level Hadid was supporting his back. They were unlike any we had seen, and yet they were not unfamiliar. As I lay there gazing idly at them, it flashed upon me that they were Egyptian. We at once fell to examining the block, and found to our amazement an obelisk of Egyptian granite, covered with Egyptian hieroglyphics of antiquity exceeding by thousands of years the most ancient monuments of the country. Verily, we were puzzled.
"When did the Egyptians invade Medica?" quoth Bozjakaz, with a solemn look, as if trying to recall a date.
"No Egyptian ever heard of Medica," said Nofel. "The obelisk was finished 20 centuries before the first Medican was weaned. In all probability it was brought here as a curiosity, just as we take to Persia the bronze head of George Washington."
We spent much time over the monument, and I think Nofel was disappointed that he could not bring it away with him. Also while in this park, we came to a high tower standing by itself and climbed to the top, where we enjoyed a wide-spreading view. The extent of the city is astounding. Miles away in the water lay the Zlotob, a white speck on the water. All about us, in every direction, as far as sight can reach, were ruins and ruins and ruins. Never was a more melancholy sight. The blue sky, the bright sunshine, the sweet-scented air with the gay flowers and singing birds only made it sadder. They seemed a mockery. We have encamped for the night, and I can write no more. Countless flying insects gather about us with a hateful buzz, and bite us beyond endurance. They are a pest thrice accursed. I told Nofel his fine theory concerning the extinction of the Yankees is a good tale for those who have never been here. No man without a leather skin could survive a second night. May 18th. Poor Jakaz is worse than sick. He had an encounter last night with a strange animal, and his defeat was ignoble. The animal, a pretty thing, much like a kitten, was hovering near when Jakaz, with rare courage and agility, threw himself upon it. And then what happened none of us can state with precision. We know we held our noses and fled. And Jakaz, no words can fit him. He carries with him an odor to devastate a province. We had to leave him ashore and send him fresh raiment. This, verily, is a land of surprises. Our hands and faces still smart from the biting insects, and the perfume of the odorous kitten promises to be ever with us. Nofel is happy. We have discovered hundreds of metal blocks, the poorest of which he asserts would be the gem of a museum. They were found by Fatan Laize in the basement of a high building, all laid carefully away on iron shelves. The flood of light they throw upon the manners and customs of this ludicrous people renders them of priceless value to historians. I harbor a suspicion that it causes Nofel some pleasure to sit upon the cool deck of the Zlotob and watch Bozjakaz walking to and fro upon the ruins of a distant wharf. May 19th. The air is cooler. Gripchilla thinks a storm is brewing.
Even Nofel is puzzled over the wooden image we brought aboard yesterday. It is well preserved, with the barbaric coloring still fresh upon it. They found it standing upright in a little shop. How these idols were worshipped, and why they were found in little shops and never in the great temples, is a mystery. It has a diadem of feathers upon the head, and as we sat smoking upon the deck this evening, I remarked to Nofel that it might be a portrait of some Medican noble, whereupon he said they had no nobles.
"But the Medicans of gentle blood," I asked, "had they no titles?"
"Neither titles nor gentle blood," he answered. "And as they were all of much the same origin, and came to this country simply to thrive more fatly than at home, there was nothing except difference in wealth on which to establish a superior order. Being deep respecters of money, this was a satisfying distinction. It soon resulted that those families who possessed riches for a generation or two became the substitute for an aristocracy. This upper class was given to sports and pastimes, spending their wealth freely, being prodigiously fond of display. Their intellectual development was feeble, and they wielded but little influence save in social matters. They followed closely the fashions of foreign aristocracies. Great attentions were paid to wandering nobles from other lands. Even distant relatives of titled people were greeted with the warmest enthusiasm."
Then I said to him, "But explain to me, O Nofel, how it was possible for so shallow a nation to become so great."
"They were great only in numbers, and too weak to endure success. At the beginning of the 20th century, as they counted time, huge fortunes were amassed in a day, and the Medicans became drunk with money."
Whereupon I exclaimed, "O land of the light! For much money is cheering!"
But the old man shook his head. "Very true, O prince, but the effect was woeful. These vast fortunes soon dominated all things, even the seat of government and the courts of justice. Tricks of finance brought fabulous gains. Young men became demoralized, for sober industry, with its moderate profits, was ridiculed."
"Verily, that would be natural," I said. "But in a land where all were rich, who was found to cook and scrub, to fetch and carry and to till the soil? For none will shovel earth when his pockets are stuffed with gold."
"All were not rich, and when the poor also became greedy, they became hostile. Then began social upheavals, with bloodshed and havoc."
May 20th. An icy wind from the northeast, with a violent rain. Yesterday we gasped with the hot air. Today we are shivering in winter clothing.
21st of May. The same as yesterday. Most of us are ill. My teeth chatter and my body is both hot and cold. A storm more wicked never wailed about a ship. Level Hadid calls the shrieking voices of 100 million of Americans who must have perished in similar weather.
17th of June. It is many days since I have touched this journal. A hateful sickness has been upon me, destroying all energy and courage. A sort of fever, and yet my limbs were cold. I could not describe it if I would.
Nofel came into the cabin this evening with some of his metal plates and discoursed upon them. He has no respect for the intellects of the early Americans. I thought for a moment I had caught him in a contradiction, but he was right as usual. It was thus.
Nofel. They were great readers.
Con Lee. You have told us that they had no literature. Were they great readers of nothing?
Nofel. Verily, thou hast said it. Vast sheets of paper were polished daily, in which all crimes were recorded in detail. The more revolting the deed, the more minute the description. Horrors were their chief delight. Scandals were drunk in with thirstful eyes. These chronicles of crime and filth were issued by hundreds of thousands. There was hardly a family in the land but had one.
Con Lee. And did this take the place of literature?
Nofel. Even so.
2 historical notes on this section. The iron monuments in the river, as close as I can tell, are the towers of the Brooklyn Bridge. The Brooklyn Bridge was completed in 1883. It was made using an interesting system where large hollow containers, caissons, were lowered into the river. They had an open bottom, so workers could go down into them and dig out the sort of mud at the bottom of the river to get to the hard rock underneath. Because the effects of pressure weren't understood then, the workers got what they called Cassian disease, what we would call the bends today, and a lot of them were really severely injured by this, including Washington Roebling, who was the main engineer. Washington Roebling took over for his father, who designed the bridge, but his father died and he took over. Then he got this Cassian disease and was basically bedridden, so he was overseeing the project from his bedroom in Brooklyn, looking at what was going on with a telescope and sending his wife to take messages back and forth to the actual workers. The same, about a week after the bridge was opened, 13 people were killed in a stampede on the bridge after someone started a rumor that the bridge was about to collapse. This people didn't gain confidence in the bridge until P.T. Barnum of the Barnum Bailey Circus led a bunch of elephants over the bridge to show everyone it was safe, and of course to advertise his own circus. The building that Lev El Hadid was found in was the Waldorf Astoria. Is a huge luxury hotel, originally built as two hotels, built in 1893 and 1897, and then linked together. The Waldorf Astoria had a private underground rail platform used as guests such as FDR, Franklin Delano Roosevelt, so that they could board a train directly from the hotel without having to go to a public train station. The bear that attacked came from the Fifth Avenue Hotel, another famous hotel in New York. The Fifth Avenue Hotel was completed in 1859. At the time it was completed, it was called a folly because it was built so far uptown that people thought it was sort of out of the urban part of New York, and therefore would never be really popular. But of course, New York expanded, and it became a prime luxury hotel. It was once known as one of the most luxurious hotels in the United States. It was the first hotel to install a passenger elevator, which the passenger elevator wasn't like elevators that we're used to. It used a revolving screw to move the elevator up. The Fifth Avenue Hotel was demolished in 1908, not too long after this book was published. The vast pleasure ground that the characters explored was Central Park. The statues that they mention, which, you know, some of them think were meant to be comic, those are serious statues. There's 29 sculptures altogether in Central Park, spread throughout the large area of the park. The Egyptian obelisk that they found it's called Cleopatra's Needle, although it doesn't actually have anything to do with Cleopatra. It was a gift to America in the 1870s by the Khedive of Egypt and Sudan. It was given to the U.S. to help build trade relationships with the U.S. Because it's so big and heavy, it took 10 years to get to the United States, and currently it's in Central Park, right behind the Museum of Art in Central Park. The high tower that they climb in the park to gain a view of the city, I think it was probably Belvedere Castle, which is still in New York, is a castle built in 1869 with a rock that was taken out of the park when the park was created. You know, large amounts of rock had to be removed. Hills were leveled out and stuff, and some of that rock was used to make this castle. On Sesame Street, the exterior of Belvedere Castle is used to when there are scenes of the Count von Count's castle in Sesame Street. And the metal boxes that they find that have pictures and words on them are, as close as I can tell, old printing plates.